So lecture four, ignore what the slide says. I hope it's the right slide set. Today is January 26th, right? No one knows? Lecture four? I think we're in the right place. Lecture notes, page 40. Before I get started, issues, questions, problems I should know about with the course, not with life in general, because I can't help you there. Anything going on we're not understanding or not expecting? Webbies, if you have any questions, issues, problems, don't forget to let me know about them. So for those of us that would like to know more about the real world of business and, I don't know, get hooked into a job sometime, Sherwin-Williams has an information table in the College of Business on the second floor on February 1st from 9:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Stop by and learn about their internship program and their career opportunities. Yay. As you know, Mini Test 1 has closed, except for a few people who have special situations. On Tuesday, average score 91%. That's good, actually. And I'm a little puzzled because almost everyone took it. And usually out of 560 students, a bunch just missed the first one. Yay, you guys, whatever's going on. Does that bode for disaster coming? I don't know. But I said to my wife, holy mackerel, what's going on here? Yes? Seven emails?
It was on
the question where it says, I'm going to be cute and then I'll actually answer, where it says on the final evaluation, uh-huh, stays in touch, uh-huh, you're going to say, holy, yes, he stays in touch.
I said, like, a
but,
D, and I was like, I know I didn't.
Say again? A D. So what might be happening, I don't know in particular because I don't get to see the student view, as I update the grade book as I go, uh-huh, and I change something and make
so
a correction.
It
could be, yes. Okay. So it might be that on your side, every time I make an update or a change, you might be getting an additional email, perhaps.
Okay.
Well, 100% is in the D?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
So I did get 100%.
Well, you should always check the grade book.
Okay.
Every week, because it's a manual update. It doesn't do it automatically. I have to do it myself. So if it shows a D, let me know. That wouldn't be right. Anybody else getting too many emails from me? Good. Okay, well, that'll continue. Mini test 2 will open tomorrow. It'll cover lectures 3 and 4. That's this week's lecture material. It'll close next Tuesday on that same schedule for most of the semester. Let me know if you have any problems with that, but it seems to be working so far remarkably well. Yay. Just a heads up. Next week, we'll have the first of the optional extra credit assignments, either using PacBack or the ELEC stuff using McGraw-Hill Connect. And this is just a foreshadowing of stuff to come. Please don't tell my wife about this offering, because I don't need her to buy a unisex cashmere shirt from God's True Cashmere. So, how many of you guys knew before this slide went up about Brad Pitt's cashmere business? Come on, guys. Hot stuff. So, Brad Pitt's cashmere sales surge as his brand plots a wholesale and a category expansion. We are currently in lecture talking about what is your strategic growth strategy? What are you planning to do? So I thought this fit in neatly with it, and it's also current. It's almost an affliction. It's got to be quality, says Brad Pitt. In his approach to God's True Cashmere, the feel-good luxury label he co-founded with his friend and holistic healer, Sat Hari. So we're seeing how they're positioning the brand. The brand's gender-neutral two-pocket cashmere work shirts in solids and tartans with handcrafted snap buttons made from healing stones like, well, you know, emeralds for health and wealth, and lapis lazuli for wisdom and truth, and labradorite for balance and protection. You guys know those stones, right? Are the latest cult, quote, casual luxe item to come out of Los Angeles. Of course, all you know what casual luxe means, but I did put the definition down there. Casual luxe is mixing comfortable casual fashion pieces like cotton t-shirts, tanks, button-down shirts, and lightweight knits with luxe fabrics, including satin, silk, sequins, lace, leather, chiffon, and other fabrics like cashmere. So they're appealing to a particular target market. Soft like a hug from Brad Pitt, no less. The $2,000 plus shirts are being snapped up by the in-the-know shoppers in stores from Serenella in Boston to Boon the Shop in Seoul, Korea. So here's the idea of price in the marketing mix, a luxury product. Here we are on their website. Here's a nice teal tartan, essentially what looks to me like a flannel shirt for $22.50. Here's a deal. The Heather Bay shirt must not be a big seller. It's only $19.80. And these are, of course, cash shirts. So I don't know what appeals to you. Maybe the Army green shirt for $19.80. Please don't tell my wife about this slide. 4 years in, God's True Cashmere is in growth mode. So what stage of the product life cycle, we'll talk about that later, are we in? With new e-commerce site, plans to launch more styles and a push to expand wholesale offerings with a showroom in Paris during the women's ready-to-wear season of March 3rd to March 6th. So we're again seeing a bit about the corporate growth strategy. Feeling better is part of the brand's ethos, reflected in online descriptions such as, each of our shirts are made in Italy with 100% cashmere, worthy of the God in you. And we made this shirt for you because you deserve to be loved. So here again, the brand's unique selling proposition. When I shop at Kohl's, I don't see those quotes with the brands that I buy. The partners are committed to building the brand on responsible luxury. Cashmere is sourced from suppliers who are responsible wool and global recycle standards certified. And the shirts are produced in a small artisan workshop in Italy with stones sourced in India. Product is shipped in organic, brushed cotton bags, and plastics are not used in displays or in storage. Those of you in fashion, but for the rest of those of you in fashion know what I'm going to say. The rest of us may not be attuned to it. There's a huge amount of criticism about much of fashion being shipped in plastic bags with multiple plastic pieces and pins and cardboard. They're just thrown away. And so this is a company that's being more socially responsible in the way they're shipping and displaying their stuff. So socially responsible marketing is going on. So there we go. A luxury strategy being implemented. I suppose these people could say, hey, why don't we start selling $75 jeans? That's a big market. No, no, that's not what we do. It's not part of our mission, right? first time, I can't get away from Super Bowl to after Super Bowl. And then even after Super Bowl, we'll have to talk about Super Bowl. But here's Super Bowl again. First time Super Bowl advertiser Workday hopes to make noise in its big game debut. A rookie Super Bowl advertiser, first time, aims to do this year what even a veteran might find challenging. Get people talking about technology they may never have known affects them every day. So here's our campaign purpose, what we're trying to do, and we're trying to build brand awareness. Workday, which is an enterprise software company used at many Fortune 500 companies, has a clever concept that it hopes will make people more aware of their software. This is like a branding company image sort of thing that it licenses to corporations that help manage finances and human resources. In a minute-long spot slated to air during the third quarter, Joan Jett, Ozzy Osbourne, and Gary Clark Jr. will be among the colorful musicians touting the company's wares. So we're seeing celebrity in advertising. Executives hope the surprise of seeing the rockers calling attention to workforce management will be enough to get football fans talking about being a rock star on the Monday morning following the game. So getting attention and target audience involvement. Here is a blurb. This is a combo that I put together of a couple of their teasers to show sort of what they're getting at with their ad. Let's see if you find it interesting or not.
You are a rock star.
Thank you.
You keep telling yourself that.
Who's the new guy?
I don't know, but he's supposed to be some kind of rock star.
Which one of you wants a piercing?
I don't see a lot of chuckles out there, so maybe it's not as funny as they think it is. So, with Fox seeking between $6 million and $7 million for a 30-second ad berth, an investment in Super Bowl advertising is not to be taken lightly. Each year, some Super Bowl marketers just make the decision willy-nilly to buy it without a lot of planning, with freshman advertisers relying on homemade concepts, small ad agencies, and their gut-level decisions. But Workday isn't doing any of that. They are doing this in a planful, thoughtful way. So here's the Super Bowl ad costs, and I say strategic, sometimes yes, sometimes no, decision making. This is something we've been budgeting for and thinking about for a while. When there are economic slowdowns, we know that companies that invest in their brands get a great return on the other side of the slowdown. We feel confident about making this investment. So again, strategic marketing investment. When we eventually talk about promotion in the mix, we're going to reinforce this idea that companies that do advertise during slowdowns usually come out better on the other end.
Well, you know, it is a challenging economic time for everybody out there, you know, all businesses, including our customers. And we know that during those times, companies that are investing in their people and their workforce end up coming out ahead. And that's certainly what we're seeing in our own business. And as we think about this ad itself, you know, taking this moment to have a Super Bowl ad, we also know that companies that invest in their brand and advertising during challenging times like this actually have a higher ROI on the other side. So it was a very conscious decision that we made to do this ad. And we expect to have a great outcome on the other side.
So consistent with things we'll talk about later. The company isn't leaving much to chance. It has already begun to seed its colorful concept with consumers using a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal to talk about employee as rock star concept, and has released an effort in social media that asks consumers to tag rock stars that they know at work. Workday is launching teasers this week. You just saw a couple of them featuring Osborne and Clark, and expects to get new attention when it unveils other musicians who are part of the ad but who've not yet been revealed. So an integrated effort to get consumers' attention and build brand awareness. How many of you have ever heard of Workday before right now as a, really, really? More than I expected. Say again?
I use Workday for two jobs that I have.
Okay, so you're a user of them. Okay, very cool. And so now you're going to be at the Super Bowl. You can say, I use them, and pick out a rock star at work. Sadly. All right, so we're going to pick up election notes, page 40, page 37 of the textbook, continuing chapter 2, which is where we left off last time, with any luck. So our question, as we were ending up last time, as we thought about our strategic directions, what are we going to do? Are we going to grow? Are we going to sustain? Are we going to divest? Are we going to invest? If you're a single company with a single product line, not that tough a thing to think about. What about when you're a big company? Multiple product lines, multiple brands, multiple strategic business units. It's big. So how are you going to think about this? And we said the way that we analyze it, and the classic approach is the BCG, the Boston Consulting Group Product Portfolio Matrix. We mentioned that they had done research and split this decision-making along two dimensions, the growth rate in the market and how dominant you were. And we said those gave us four quadrants: stars, cash cow, problem children, and dog. And we said today we'd talk a little bit about what that means as you think about these product lines, brands, strategic business units. So if you are dominant in a low growth market, obviously there's not huge growth in sales happening. There's not a lot of churn going on. Things have stabilized. It's pretty slow. Because you're dominant, unless you're screwing up somehow, you should have strong profits out there. And those profits should be generating a lot of cash for your organization. But because you're so dominant, because there's not a lot of churn, because there's not a lot of growth and competitive activity, and you're way bigger than your competition anyhow, it doesn't require a lot of cash resources to stay a cash cow, some. So now you've got a bunch of cash, a bunch of profits. What do you do with those? Well, presumably, what you're going to do is flow these out somewhere in your organization, and here we're suggesting you might want to flow them out to appropriate problem children, which we'll talk about in a minute. Does that make sense? You can picture what's going on. We're established. We're big. There's not a lot of churn. We're just a massive entity in this slow growth market. Money is rolling in for us. Good us. All right. So we talked about the problem children or the question marks. These folks have low market share, not as big as the competition, and a high growth market. Rising tide raises all ships. High growth market brings all companies upwards. So, by definition, there's high growth in the sales. But because you're small relative to other folk, your profits are probably not that strong. So if your strategy for this particular question mark or problem child is to have it become dominant, you got to spend money in it. If it's not to have it become dominant, you ought to forget about it. Let it dwindle away. But what is your strategy for this one? What's your vision of the future? If you're dominant in a high growth market, you have high growth in sales, it's profitable, but it's going to require attention. Why does this require so much attention? Because it's high growth, there's lots of churn, there's lots of competition. People want to get your customers away. They want what you got. And so what you want to do is spend the cash and resources as appropriate to stay dominant. Logically, what's going to happen to all high growth markets eventually over time? What's going to happen to those? The growth rate. Eventually, it's going to slow down. It's going to level off. It's going to go below that 10%. Where would you like to be positioned with that product line, with that brand, or with that strategic business unit? You'd like to be really big as the growth rate slows down. Suddenly, you're going to have another cash cow. So, with any luck, you'll become a cash cow in the future. And then we have some product lines, some brands, some strategic business units that are dogs. Now, dogs are cute. How many people have dogs at home as a pet? Yeah. But at the same time, it's probably not a good thing for your business to have a lot of dogs. Why? Because there's not a lot of sales growth there. Sales growth, by definition, is low. Because you're small, you don't have a lot of profits rolling out of this thing. You're not generating a lot of cash flow. You probably don't have a really strong future within the organization. So it's probably not a place for somebody in the organization, let's spend a lot of money on that one. So it's not a good place for cash resources to be reinvested. Let's step back from the writing for a second and ask yourself an interesting question. Should we find companies, do we want to find companies that don't have any of these problem children, question marks, that don't have any dogs? Would you say that's great management? That's a good idea. Let's not have those things out there. Would you say, yes, we want some of those out there? Seems like it's a yes-no choice. Which are you voting for? None or some?
Maybe some.
Why? So let's defend, what's your name?
Gabe.
Let's defend Gabe's position. Why might you have some problem children or dogs? Somebody help me out here. It's always hard when I try to ask them to think. You know, it's tough. I won't make fun of you. Yeah, okay, we got an answer. Watch your cord here as I wander up the... I stubbed my toe, so I'm limping all the way up here. I think he knew that. That's why he's calling me up here. Why is it probably not a terrible idea to have problem children or dogs? You got to take risks. If you're never making any new ventures, if you're never out there trying, eventually that cash cow itself is eventually going to go away because things have moved on and you haven't done anything. You don't want an overload of those, but you got to try new things. You got to see if things are working. Some of those problem children will become dogs. You got to decide what to do, probably the best of them. And some of those will become stars. So too conservative, you won't have any of those, but you probably won't be in business for the long run. Thank you. So here's an example for Coca-Cola. What is Coca-Cola's probably cash cow, would you say? Well, Coca-Cola Classic. Is there huge growth in Coca-Cola Classic sales? No. They've been there a long time. People are still buying Coke, but not en masse. And are they pretty big in that particular cola industry? Yeah. So for them, Coca-Cola is probably a cash cow. They're pulling in a lot of money. There's not a lot of huge competition in the cola market. Problem child for them, when I put this together, I haven't checked recently, is Minute Maid orange juice. Apparently at the time, a growth market, but they are not a huge market share of it. There are a lot of different orange juices out there. When I put this together, bottled water, going gangbusters, lots of sales in bottled water. Dasani, pretty big out there. So that was a star for them. And they had a couple of dogs. Coca-Cola Life Anybody remember seeing the green thing, Coca-Cola Life? No? Oh, did you see it? Okay. Not there anymore that I know of. A Coca-Cola Black, I mentioned it before, we'll talk about it again, was a terrible idea. They did some research studies, which I'll talk about when we do market research, and they found that some people like to drink cola in the morning to get started. And what else do people like to drink in the morning? Coffee. So they came up with this great idea. What if we invented a cola that was coffee flavored? So carbonated, coffee flavored cola. Signing on for that? Nobody else did either. They didn't like it. Didn't turn out. So that was a dog they got rid of. If we move over to the technology area, again, they're still selling PCs. Dell is. Sales are slowing down. But in that arena, they're still a big player. Problem child for them is the cloud market space. Lots of stuff going on there, but they're going against Amazon Cloud, Google Cloud, IBM Cloud. They're going against a lot of clouds. For them, Dell monitors, still a big thing as people buy up monitors to use at home while working away from the office. And one that didn't work out for them, Dell smartphone. They got in that market, didn't grow. For them, off they went. Yeah? So this is them thinking about their strategy in 2018. That's not the only portfolio analysis tool out there. This is one that came out of General Electric a while ago, the directional policy matrix. You can see the basic idea is similar, though, as you think about your various product lines, brands, strategic business units. On the left-hand side, how attractive is this market to you that you could find yourself in, that you acquired over time, whatever? And how strong is your competitive position? To be very simplistic, if it's very attractive and you're strong, well, gee, don't you think you should maintain your leadership? That's not a hard one to think about. If it's not very attractive and you're weak, maybe you should get rid of it. Just let it go. So for Procter & Gamble, attractive market for them where they're strong, Pampers baby diapers, Tide, Fusion, men's razors, they probably ought to keep those brands going pretty good, yeah? On the other hand, they did acquire and then harvested, sold off, got rid of Energizer Bunny batteries. Is that a bad brand, Energizer brand? It's not bad, just didn't fit into their portfolio of what they wanted to do. It wasn't very attractive in terms of their overall mission, strategy, goals. They acquired it with something else probably. And while it's in a medium competitive position, they just said, look, it's not fitting with our strategy. Let's get rid of it. So you can see how this might help you think strategically about those product lines, those brands, the strategic business units. So we decide we want to grow for whatever reason strategically. How are we going to do that? Well, you can see here we have two basic approaches. Should we sell to current markets or to new markets? Should we sell current products or new products? So if we decide the way for us to grow is to sell more of our product to our existing customers, then we're engaged in market penetration as a growth strategy. Sephora Beauty Insider Rewards Program has, since it's come out, 25 million loyal members. Their loyal membership and user base grew as a result of this loyalty program. Or we might say, look, let's get some new products out there and sell them to consumers who know us, to our existing consumers, as another growth strategy. So we know Apple, right? And Apple was always out there with new iPhones, iPads, iPods, watches, Apple TVs, etc., etc., etc. New products. Who has the latest Apple iPhone? Just out of curiosity. Who's bought the latest? Usually there's way more hands than that going up. There's a lot of people that often have that latest one. What was wrong with the old one? Nothing. But you bought the new one. Yeah. Okay. More new products to existing customers. Or we might think about it differently. Let's sell our current products to, I don't know what I said a minute ago. Did I say that wrong? New products to current customers, yeah. Sell current products to new customers. So Razor, you guys know Razor Scooters? Anybody have a Razor Scooter? Yeah? Razor Scooters has recently paid careful attention to adults who had scooters when they were kids. This is our new market strategy. So remind them of the fun they had with their scooter as a kid. Here's the adult scooter, selling our current product to new to us audiences. Or let's diversify. Let's sell an entirely new product for us to an entirely new audience. Sony recently set up an electric vehicle unit. Not what you think of when you think of Sony, is it? What do you think of when you think of Sony? Or you don't think of anything. What comes to mind? Televisions. They're now doing EVs. And it's considering entering the electric vehicle market. So maybe it'd have a really good TV in it. I don't know. All right, so what approach makes sense for you given your strategic picture, given your analysis, given your competitive situation, your consumers, etc.? To help us see what's going on with all those things that are working out there, we use marketing dashboards. Marketing dashboards are, of course, the visual display on a single computer screen of the essential information related to achieving a marketing objective. And I think when I first introduced this concept, it was sort of a new idea. I think we've all seen dashboards of different types by now, a screen that shows you some measures of things that you're interested in following. Here's Don. Here's our guy, Don Joseph. Tell us a little bit about how he was making use of marketing dashboards.
First of all, the internet has made a huge, huge increase in the amount of information that comes available, first of all, as a general manager of the store. It almost has made it to where we get too much information. We get too many items to available to view. If I sat there and looked at dashboards all day long, which are available, I would be there all day just looking at the internet and numbers, that type of thing. But I have the ability of information systems that we use at the dealership that actually can tell me where sales processes are or where sales are in all departments at any given time. I can look at it 24/7. I have the ability to look at it when I'm not at work. But dashboards play an integral part. I can see how many customers have walked into the store, how many of those customers have taken it through that step-by-step process, where they are in that process, to where we've actually sold them, and where then are they have gone into finance yet, that type of thing. Where is the deal after it's left finance? Have we been paid from the bank? I can follow a deal anywhere from the beginning to end. And the same thing with my service department. I have the ability to look from the moment a customer walks into the door and we write a repair order on it to the point to where we get paid at the very end, whether it be from the bank or from Toyota themselves. But dashboards have created it so much. It's so much easier to look and get information at a glance at any point in time. You can see where you're at in a business standpoint of view. So yes, I use them every day.
So as a manager, I have goals for my sales staff. I have goals for them converting a certain number of people who walk in the door to looking at a car, to doing a test drive, to moving on to a sales, to moving on to getting them over to our credit department. We have to make sure that the credit department is doing right by our consumers and accepting people who should be accepted and rejecting people who aren't. We don't want a bunch of people given credit who can't pay for the car. That would be a problem for us. On the service side, do we have whatever our goal is for turnaround, for the amount of time spent, for the amount of happy customers? Whatever those metrics are, boom, our marketing dashboards can tell us easily how we're doing against the metrics that we set up. So it's important there. DataPine says, hey, unlock the full potential of your data with dashboards that will measure what you need to measure. So here's our management overview, the number of active customers, the units sold, Europe, so the pounds sold, and we can check by different areas, etc., etc.
Welcome to our dashboard interactivity overview video. When sitting in a meeting, it is no longer enough to just have nice looking dashboards to display your insights. You also need to be prepared to answer complex questions on the fly.
Okay, so you're a manager, you're in a meeting, here come these questions. What are we doing in this area? What are we doing in this region? What are we doing by this product line? Boom, Dashboard's going to help us out.
The biggest thing is...
So here he's talking over at Don Joseph about Dashboards and effectiveness of our marketing media. It's often hard to know. How are our ad dollars doing? Are they working? How? Where? How about some dashboards for that?
The biggest thing is I notice is I use it to measure the type of media that I might be using. If I have a newspaper ad that has a date on it, that the sale goes from this day to this day, might be a three-day period, I'll look and compare on that dashboard to see, did I get an increase in traffic flow at that point in time? And it can tell me right now, right away, what they did. Even in that dashboard, it can tell me, we have it defined down from the salesperson, the information they entered in, what source of media did they actually use to come into the store. And, you know, we'll be able to track it and see, did that piece work for us? You know, we talk about dashboards and that type of thing. I mean, reports are just unbelievable, but we actually put a different phone number on types of media. So I can track it to see if that actually made an increase in customer awareness or the ability to come into our store. So, yes.
So, hi, how you doing? What brought you into our shop today? How did you hear about us? And it might be word of mouth. A friend told me. It might be a web thing. It might be an ad on social media. It might be the Hudson Hub. It might be the Stowe Sentry. It might be the Record Courier. It might be a phone call coming in. We record all that information, and we know when we were and when we weren't running ads, right? And so we can see, what's the impact of the Hudson Hub versus the Stowe Sentry? Is it driving customer traffic or not? How would you know that otherwise? Pretty hard to know. Record it, analyze it, get your answers out. I forget, anybody here in ISIT? ISIT people, information systems, MNIS, that side of the house? Those are the people we need helping us out as marketers behind the scenes for us. So, once we have this information off our dashboard, we can use the data to take effective actions. I notice you sales guys are doing a great job converting people as they come in, getting them to see the brochure, getting them into try the car, working down. You guys over there, they're coming in, but I see you aren't getting many of them into the car for a test drive. You keep doing what you're going to do. You guys, I think we'd have to do some sales training, maybe a day off to improve our skills based on what we find out. Record Courier, you're doing a great job. Hudson Hub, not so much. We got to rethink that. At the strategic level, we have to see how we're situated out in the world and think about how we can position ourselves given what's going on in the world around us. You guys know SWOT analysis from management or other places? SWOT? SWOT, SWOT, yeah. So what we say is, internally, clearly we have some strengths and some weaknesses. Yeah? Duh. And externally, there are opportunities, but there are also threats. So what we want to do is cross over these ideas and see what our strengths and weaknesses are, and what our opportunities and threats are, and see how that guides our strategic management process. So up here in our framework, we have the idea of SWOT analysis, and the output of doing a SWOT analysis is going to help us to assess what market opportunities we might have, what we might want to go after, given our mission and objectives. So Fred Hunt is over at Sherwin-Williams. He's going to talk to us about the literal importance of doing SWOT analysis at the high level of the organization, the strategic level. He's going to comment there are other things that go on as you get closer down to the department level, to your job when you get hired. There are different types of analysis, but he feels this is really important.
There are a few techniques from the MBA experience that gets used in the, you know, more than the SWOT analysis. You know, as it may not be formally said, but in almost not every meeting, but when we start talking about strategy, you almost always go back to that because it really helps to ground where you are and ask the questions of yourself, the deep questions, not of yourself, but also those who work with you. Are we really there? Are we doing what we're supposed to do? And where do we see the strengths, the weaknesses, the opportunities, the threats? And from that comes, on each one of those points, potentially a much larger strategy, but you at least need to be honest with yourselves and start at that point. There are other techniques that we use as we move down and try to get down to a more refined strategy, but that really is a core for many discussions.
So how do we interpret this? Well, we look inside ourselves and we say, what are our strengths? What are our weaknesses? We have strength in our sales area, but our service side isn't doing so well. What should we do when we discover this problem? Well, first you have to discover the weakness by doing the analysis, which not everyone does. And then you have to find some way to fix the problem, make it a strength, right? Go train those salespeople. Go do an analysis on the service side and see what's going on. Move that weakness to a strength. What about a threat in the world around us? Well, sometimes we know it's there because we've done the analysis, and we just don't see a way that we're going to do anything about it. Can you find some way to move around it, to avoid it? Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. Or can we find a way to convert it into an opportunity? Sony looks around the world and says, the world of automotive is changing to electric. It's not clear to me why Sony feels that they have a great opportunity to build EV cars, but they say, there's an opportunity for us, given who we are and how we deal with technology. Let's move into that area. And the perfect situation, of course, is when your opportunity matches one of your strengths. Boom, you gotta know that, jump on that, and develop that market, arguably. But you only know that if you do the SWOT analysis in an honest way. So there's the actual action that you can base at the strategic level based on your SWOT analysis. Over at Protégé, Patrick, he's working for a market research company, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about how they deal with SWOT at this research
Protégé, the flagship brand that we were founded under is Swagbucks. That is a member rewards platform. In addition to that, we also acquired three other similar rewards platforms that complement Swagbucks. We have 120 million members globally. Anything that you would do online, such as shopping, booking travel, watching videos, playing games, our members can come to our websites and earn points back, much like you would be used to by using your credit card. Back in 2009, our chief revenue officer, Mendy, he saw an opportunity for one of those avenues to earn points back being answering a poll. When they put that out to our ecosystem of members, he saw that there was a trend in people really being willing to share their opinions. And so that kind of started what became our market research side of the business. From 2009 to 2014, we were kind of behind the scenes. Really, not many people knew about us, and even in the industry. And that was because we were selling the wholesale relationship to some of the other big research firms. So we were powering their surveys in the background. After 2014, we saw an opportunity to move direct and have more relationships with, say, a Kent State or market research firms or agencies. And so now we work with a slew of clients, thousands of clients that are really in any industry that has like a marketing team or an insights team that would want to pick up on trends, whether it's for testing ad concepts, new products that they're coming up with, store displays, what have you.
So here's a company, it has 120 million members earning rewards and being part of their program, but research isn't a big deal for them at the time. Somebody does an analysis and says, out in the world, a lot of companies want to talk to people and get their opinions, get some research from them. What's one of our strengths? Having people willing to interact with us. Let's first ask them and see if they're interested in doing that. They are. Boom! An entire new business springs up, because somebody had the ability and the foresight to do the SWOT analysis, see what one of their strengths was, see an opportunity out there, and develop this new business, which has worked rather well for them. So it grows to support many businesses who need consumer research. So we've done some analysis. We have to keep in mind that we have to have a market product focus, and we have to think about our goals as well. One approach to key approach to doing marketing is market segmentation. We look out into all the, if I'm a business, hundreds, if I'm B2B or B2C, millions of people out there, and we know not everybody wants the same thing from us. In fact, some people don't want anything from us. So first we do market segmentation by identifying groups of buyers who have common needs, wants, desires. They share them. And those people who have a shared set of needs, wants, and desires will respond differently to a marketing effort compared to everybody else. For example, our good friend Brad Pitt has a particular target audience in mind. Yeah? A group of people who are into luxury products. But not just that. Luxury products, what else was the Brad Pitt example for Cashmere about? The other part of his brand? What was it?
Gender neutral.
Sustainability. Those are good points. What was the other key thing that goes into the design of each shirt? Still can't hear you. The health stones, the healing property of the stones. So he's really segmented the market out there. He wants to focus on a group of people who are willing to spend $2,000 or so on a shirt that's sustainable, that has health properties from the stones with it. That's a pretty specific segment. Other people, how many of you guys would buy that shirt today? How many of you guys would like to buy it tomorrow? One guy. Okay, the rest of y'all are not part of his market. You aren't a segment that he's interested in. Target marketing, then, is having identified segments with different needs, wants, and desires, selecting one or more of those segments, given who we are, our need, their needs, wants, and desires, our mission and abilities, and developing a marketing plan to serve one or more target audiences at the strategic level. So here we are one more time. We've done our SWOT. We're assessing our market opportunities. We're evaluating those market segments that we've identified through our segmentation process, and we're selecting out one or more target markets to focus our marketing objectives and strategy on. We have to recognize that in order to be successful with a group of consumers, we have to give them a value proposition. Chapter one, as you recall, was about how marketing provides value. So what is it that you are going to promise to satisfy for that target audiences in terms of their needs, wants, and desires? Whatever you're offering has to be relevant to them. We all need clothes. We don't all need a $2,000 casual cashmere shirt. It's not relevant. Whatever your point is has to be clear. It sounds like his positioning statement for what he's selling is pretty clear. We mostly got it. And your customer value proposition has to state why consumers should purchase from you and not the competition. What is your point of differentiation? What is your unique selling proposition? It's going to be pretty hard for Levi's to start selling sustainably sourced, high-end, luxe clothing with health gems sewed in. It's not something somebody's just going to jump into. You're special. And apparently some people want you since you're growing. So this helps us then to set up our marketing objectives, leads us to our marketing strategy, and then the marketing mix we're going to develop. Mostly we've been thinking about bigger companies, major companies. This next guy has a little bit of a counterintuitive approach to things. He talks about jumbo shrimp marketing. It's a little off the main thing that we usually think about. What can you do if you're a smaller business, and how can you grow in an appropriate way? Let's hear what he has to say about this.
Jumbo shrimp marketing. Get bigger by acting smaller. When small businesses dream, they usually dream of becoming a bigger business. When you think about it, nearly every big business began as a small business. Nike's first sale came from the trunk of a car. Dell shipped its first custom-built computer from a college dorm room. And Starbucks, well, began its life as a mom-and-pop coffee shop. However, a bigger business doesn't always equate to being a better business. At some point, big becomes bad. Big becomes a matter of being convenient rather than being unique. Big becomes a game of market share, not customer care. Big becomes ubiquitous. seems by the time a small business gets big, it's time for it to act small again. Paradoxical? You betcha. Impractical? No. There are countless businesses which have managed to get bigger, but still retain their semblance of smallness. They get bigger by acting smaller. In essence, these businesses are like jumbo shrimp. Big, yet small. How can your business get bigger by acting smaller? You can start by following these five jumbo shrimp marketing rules.
So he's not saying getting big is bad. He's saying when you get big, there's a tendency to forget about what made you special. Forget about why people came to you when you were small. So what strategies can you use to grow but pay attention to your history? Well, one is don't focus on trying to be the biggest in your industry. That's going to probably lead you down the wrong path. However, if you focus on being the best in your particular segment to your particular target audience, you're probably going to grow, right? People want to work with the company that's the best. Second, love your business. Does anybody work with a company, an organization, a retail establishment where the people you work with or for love their business? Anybody shop at a place where the people that you shop from love their business? Do you mind sharing your example? Okay, let me stroll around here. Yes, I know I'm limping. Don't worry about it. It'll be okay. Yeah?
I just work at Dillard's. Everyone there loves working there.
People love working there. Does it show with the customers? Did it show with your interaction? Do people like to be there? Yes. How many people have shopped at a place the opposite? The people there clearly don't want to be there, don't want to help you. Does that make you want to rush back to them? Not so much. Okay? Love your business. Love what you're doing. Passion attracts passion. If you're passionate for your business, you're going to draw in passionate employees and passionate customers. Treat employees like family because they are the people that carry your mission forward to the consumer, and redefine success. Maybe not as being the biggest, but being the best is the way to think about these things according to him, a different way of thinking about it. Here's an example of a company that seems to be, at least in theory, behind the idea of being successful but being small.
Hey, if you want all the technology and products of a big bank, but with the personal attention of a true local bank, head to Farmers National Bank. Farmers, bigger small banking.
Must have read Jumbo Shrimp, right? Must have read the idea of being bigger, in a sense, by being a small bank. Third step, now that we've worked our way down this process of strategy, down to the target market, down to the objectives, is to develop the marketing mix. What's the product? What's the price? What's the place? What's the promotion that would appeal to this new segment, to this new target audience? Product, price, promotion, and place. What's going to work for our consumers? So here we are. We've followed ourselves coming down, and now we're down at product, price, place, promotion, the marketing program out to the consumer. Hopefully the market response, of course, will be purchase. This is the way that our friends in the book puts it all together. These four elements, product, price, promotion, and place, put together as a single integrated unit, a cohesive marketing plan appealing to that target audience that we just developed. Now, if you're in the organization making this work, you got to convince them to give you the resources. That could be employees, could be space, could be money to make it work. Then you're going to design that marketing organization, the salespeople, the ad people, etc. You're going to develop the schedules for the rollout of the promotion, the rollout of the product, the sales of the things, and you're going to execute the marketing program at a strategic level.
There's a tool we use, and I don't know what.
Here is the next step, which is evaluating the end result of your plan.
There's a tool we use, and I don't know whether it's used widely. It's called SharePoint, and I'm guessing it's probably a Microsoft tool. And we use it to create these communities of interest on key performance indicators. And besides having that information available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we also review those key performance indicators monthly in performance reviews where we compare our business plan against actual results and whether it's you know, the financials, revenue, profitability, all the way down to warehouse error rates, customer service, number of calls, abandoned call rate, all the details of running a business. We review those key performance indicators every month. It's a pretty rigorous process, and there's no escaping it. Everyone goes through it every month, and it really has created a nice rigor in our business that everyone expects it, everyone watches those, and I think, as a lot of people said, you know, what you measure, people will pay attention to, and their behavior will respond to what you measure. And so we try to make sure we measure the right things.
Okay. Does SharePoint sort of pop it up on your screen in an integrated fashion, so you see it minute by minute, day by day, or is it a once a month sort of thing you look at?
It's basically something that you have to go look at. But it does so in a way that in the morning when you log on, and the very first screen you see is a list of all the SharePoints that you have determined as an individual are important to you.
So it's a form of a dashboard, SharePoint. You're able to see the important indicators to you. A basic management tenet, principle of management, is that people pay attention to what you measure. Does that seem like a no-brainer? It is. I had a colleague once, a faculty member in marketing, and we were chatting, and he said, "I don't understand it. Students are not reading the book for this class." I said, "Oh, well, that doesn't seem so good." I said, "What percentage of your tests cover the book?" What do you suppose his answer was? "I don't test over the book." Well, what do you expect them to do? You're not going to test them on reading the book. And then you expect them to read the book. People, pay attention to what you measure. If you want these people to get better sales training and improve their percentage of people getting over to test driving, do the training and then test. Watch what's going on, seeing did it improve or not. They know they're going to be watched, and you're watching them. How are your sales going compared to what your plan is? How's your advertising working compared to what your plan is, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah? So people are going to pay attention to what you measure. Use your dashboards as appropriate to evaluate the results. So this is the idea of feedback. And what happens after feedback? You evaluate, you control, and you go back to make changes as necessary as a manager. Just for your information, we're now through with Chapter 2. Behind Chapter 2 is Appendix A in the book. Appendix A is not testable, so you can skip over it if you like. Don't worry about it for the test. But it might be of interest. We're too large, in my opinion, and no too little, to spend time building an effective marketing plan. But if you're trying to start a business, if you're interested in a future business, if you're interested in entrepreneurship, you might find that chapter interesting. We're not going to test on it. So don't worry about me measuring it. You don't have to study it. I'm not going to test on it. Okay? Questions on anything we just talked about in Chapter 2 as we thought about this idea of strategic planning, marketing objectives, strategic objectives, anything come to mind? Can't hear you, Webby, so you have to type. Okay. All right, so on to Chapter 3, scanning the marketing environment. I've already emphasized by this point, I want to check on something, make sure this is the right file. If you have the lecture notes, am I on page 49? Let me know if this is the right file. Let me know if something looks goofy relative to what you have in your thing. Sometimes the wrong file pops up. So who is it in the organization that spends time seeing what's going on in the environment and how it's going to impact our consumers, marketers? So this is the idea of scanning the marketing environment. This is the process of continually acquiring information on events that occur outside the organization. The point of phrasing it that way is, as a manager, you can control a bunch of things inside your firm, training of the salespeople, the service staff, whatever. But you can't control a bunch of stuff outside the firm that's going to impact your consumers and you. So we have to have folks watching this, identifying what's going on out there, the trends, the potential impact it's going to have on us, interpret things as threats or, for that matter, opportunities. This requires data collection and the intelligent managerial assessment, although maybe one day AI will do this for us, the intelligent assessment and interpretation of the information given our mission, objectives, competition, marketplace, abilities, etc. So we need marketing and data analytics. Anybody taking that course? Marketing analytics. Okay. So hopefully some of the stuff you're going, yeah, that makes sense. That's what I want. Yeah, will do, am doing, want to do. So where are we in our framework? We're monitoring and predicting those environmental change factors outside the organization that we can't control. The CREST factors, competition, regulation, legal and political, economic, social, technology, things that impact our consumers that will impact our business. And we have to think about how that's going to impact those consumers. So here they are one more time. CREST, impacting our consumer and so impacting our marketing mix. Let's take a look at some of these factors and see what it is we're talking about. I think I've organized them the way they're organized in the book, so instead of being CREST, it's some other spelling of the acronym. We're going to start with social forces. These are factors in a society that bring about changes in the attitudes of our population, of our consumers, of our target audience, their beliefs, what they think is true and not true, their norms, how they think we ought to behave, their customs, and their lifestyles. How are they changing? How does it impact our consumers? How does it impact us? These things affect how people live and what, where, and how they buy. My own example, to give you a sense of what I'm talking about here, but it's a teeny, teeny part of social forces in terms of attitudes, beliefs, norms, and customs and lifestyles, I like to say, when I grew up, I'm a little bit kidding here, there are two types of people that had piercing or tattoos, convicts and sailors. That was it. It wasn't a thing. There was not an opportunity for three businesses downtown to do piercings and tattoos. It wouldn't have been thought of. It was not part of the attitudes, beliefs, norms, customs, and lifestyle of the normal, everyday population. How many of you guys, either personally or know someone who either has piercing or tattoos? That would have never happened 50 years ago. But it is now, because slowly over time, the attitudes about these things have shifted and changed. And there's business opportunities now in those areas, right? COVID-19 was an external force that impacted people's, how they live, what they, where they, and how they buy, as an example of a social force. So one social force is the demographics out there of the general population. This is the population's characteristics such as their age, their gender, their ethnicity, their income, their occupation. Might it be important for you to know those factors about a particular segment of the country that you're thinking about going into as a region? What's the age demographics here? What's the income demographics? Who tends to live here? What do they do? At a very high level, we get things like the U.S. and world population clock. I should have asked this before it popped up. How many people know about what the U.S. population is roughly? Oh, about 334,315,680-something. Right, okay. How about the world population? 7 billion. What's the 10 most populous countries in the world as of July 1st, 2023? That looks like it's a bit of a projection. China, India, the U.S., Indonesia, Pakistan. So this is just a bit of info that you can get. You would want much more deep analysis. What about the population of the United States by age, by gender? So how many folks are 97 years and above? Well, not that many left, but there's more women than men, 94 and above, 89. And of course, each of these represents a different generation, which we're going to talk about shortly. And who's the biggest one out there? If you're thinking about going to various states, what's the population of those states? What about cities? How are we looking in terms of those things? So the point would be, lots of demographic information out there that might be interesting as you're thinking about rolling out to a particular area. Here's just another cut of this information at a worldview if you're interested. So, speaking of these different folks at different age groups, you certainly heard about generations. Let's think about this idea of generational cohorts. We're on page 77, 78 of the textbook. We're going to go into more detail than they go into. So let's go back in time to the baby boomers. These are folks born between 1946 and 1964. Generation X, 65 to 76. Generation Y, 77 to 94. And millennials, yes. The younger Gen Yers, 81 to 94, they can't always agree on the dates. They sometimes like to confuse themselves. Generation Z, 95 to 2010. You know anybody in that age group? Duh. And anybody know what the next generation is being called? I haven't rolled around to them yet. Anybody know what the next one's called? Generation Alpha. They ran through the alphabet. They didn't plan this very well when they first started doing it. And they said, Z, we're out of letters. What are we going to do? Let's start with A. So we're going to Generation Alpha next. So recent resident population in the U.S. in 2021, by generation in millions. There's still a few of those greatest generation people there, born between 1928. And if you have a great-grandma, great-grandpa that is in that age group, still alive? Yeah, okay, good for that. Probably grandma, great-grandma, probably. Then we have the silent generation. The baby boomers, for a long time, the baby boomers were really massive in the population, and their attitudes and lifestyles and norms and likes and dislikes controlled a lot of the world around them. They were such a big group. Generation X, the millennial generation, born 81 to 95, they became the largest cohort group in the country in 2019. Now their attitudes and norms and lifestyles and behaviors and values are driving a lot of what's happening. And of course, Generation Z at 68 million, almost 69 million as of the date we put this together, okay? So here are, you know, we're going back in time again. A little more broadly than the textbook, the greatest generation, 1901 to 1945. Within that, we have the Depression cohort, 1912 to 1921. Some of those people are still kicking around, not too many. Subset of the World War II cohort, 22 to 27. The post-war cohort, 28 to 45. Baby boomers, the leading edge, 46 to 55. The trailing edge, 56 to 64. Generation X, Generation Y, Generation Z, most of y'all, also known as iGen, Gen Tech, Digital Natives, and NetGen. And then, as I said, Generation Alpha, 2011 until today. And you see different dates, perhaps even in my slides, because the researchers can't agree precisely on where the dividing line is. So why do we care about this at all? Why am I harping on these generational cohorts? Because they have different needs, wants, desires, attitudes, backgrounds, etc. Different things are important to them. In terms of their needs, wants, and desires, they then represent potential target markets for us that have different needs, wants, and desires, different from one another. Think about an important thing in the world of commerce, in the world of business, home ownership. Homeowners spend their money a lot differently than do renters on the furniture that they buy, whether or not they buy garden equipment and supplies. How many folks renting go out and buy a garden tractor thing, you know, to cut their lawn? Nobody. It's not my problem. Somebody else cuts the lawn. You own a home and you have a nice tract of land. What do you want? Either a big walk behind mower or a driving mower. Food, meal delivery. There are generational differences in home ownership that come back to affect our business. Home ownership rate by generation, the silent generation by 2020, it was always high, it's still pretty high. Baby boomers grew up over time, and as they aged, we had more home ownership. Gen X, millennials, and here we see the Great Recession of 2008, flattening things out for some of these folks, but well over 60% of the older generations own their own homes, compared to less than 50% of the millennial target audience. Millennials in the U.S. postpone buying a home until they have adequate savings. The delay can also be attributed to the fact that people nowadays aren't in a rush to get married and to settle down. old days, that was the thing, man. If you were 22 years old, not married, there was something wrong. You were becoming an old man or an old maid. Today, 22, I'm not rushing to get married, let alone to settle down and buy a house. Different attitudes change over time. So these Depression era cohort, the GI generation, 1912 to 1921 in birth, they're old today. There's not a huge market out there, 102 plus years old. This group's coming of age experience consisted of economic strife, elevated unemployment rates, having to take menial jobs to survive. Here we see folks in a food line during the Great Depression. So what drives their thinking to the extent they're still active? Financial security. What they lacked most when they came of age rules their thinking. The Great Depression left a big impact on these people. They lived through the Depression. This cohort prefers to pay more for a smaller serving rather than throw something away. They weren't always 102. They were 100. They were 99. They were 95. At that age, they were still influencing our marketplace. For example, while they're not a key audience now, their values influenced marketers. Given their earlier preferences, single-serving products have now become popular in the general population. Maxwell House filter pack singles, Pillsbury single-serve cakes, Orville Redenbacher single-serve microwave popcorn are all examples of these folks' lifestyle. Again, I can't quite judge whether you ever ran into this from your grandparents or great-grandparents, but the idea of throwing away food from the table, you know, that popcorn, what do you mean you're going to throw it away? Save it. What are you going to throw it away? Anybody ever run into that as an attitude from older folk? Why? It's nothing. They grew through the Great Depression. They were hungry. You didn't throw away food. Marketers came up with these things to satisfy them. They're still around. The Greatest Generation, or the Solid Generation, or the World War II cohort, 1922 to 1927, 96 to 101 in 2023, sacrifice for the common good was widely accepted among the members of the World War II cohort. Women went to work in the factories for the war effort. Men went off to fight against Nazi power or the evil Axis. Overall, this cohort was focused on defeating a common enemy, and their members are more team-oriented and patriotic than those of other generational cohorts, meaning you can appeal to them a few years ago, but maybe still today, with themes of patriotism. In form of communication, given how old they are, they definitely prefer print media. I'm getting at an age where sometimes when I pull up that teeny little thing on Snapface or FaceChat or whatever, what's going on there? I can't see that. It's gone. They read newspapers, magazines, and ads more thoroughly than do other generations. For the mature market in general, communicating often requires you to alter your message and your material. Give them larger type. Give them clear, bright pictures. Put your material in newspapers or on AM radio. Give them older models that they can relate to. Use simple language so as not to confuse them. They aren't dumb, they're old. So take that into consideration. Post-war cohort, born 28 to 45, age 78 to 95 in 2023. These folks experienced a time of remarkable economic growth and social tranquility. A time of family togetherness, school dress codes, moving out to the suburbs, which were just being developed. While there were some elements of unrest, there was the Korean conflict, it was McCarthyism against communism. Overall, this was a time of remarkable economic growth, social tranquility, which is why this is such a long, big cohort. Anybody know the Vermont Country Store for any reason? I'm not too sure what it says about my cohort because I do get the Vermont County catalog at home. I'm not sure what they're saying about me. But this is a highly successful set of marketers who sell nostalgic products that are hard to find. And they use cohort images that appeal to the post-war cohort and their memories to target various market segments. To capture the attention of the post-war cohort customers, it carries many older brands and even brings them back to life for this consumer group. Let's take a look at the Vermont Country Store. Next time, we'll look at the Vermont Country Store. End of the material for mini test 2, whatever it is today. I'll send you an email to let you know about it. We'll open mini test 2 tomorrow, and next week we'll hear from the Vermont Country Store.